Our stewardship campaign this year is Growing Our Generosity. I'd like you to please welcome member Cheryl Guy to speak to us for a couple of minutes on that theme.
So our pledge campaign this year, the theme is Growing Our Generosity, and you've heard it referred to the last three, 4 weeks. People have kind of been alluding to that. So I'm going to explain a little bit about the campaign, what we're doing this year, the timeline, and the packets, which some of you have already picked up. Everybody has them at the back at the table with our membership and stewardship team people. So everybody will have one. If your name is not in the alphabetized list, we do have extras as well. If you're a visitor, you're also welcome to pick one up if you want to be informed of what's going on. So let me walk you just a little bit through the packet and kind of explain how I put it together and why. So the top of the packet is your pledge card. You need to keep this. It's like your lifeline to existence. But please don't hand them in until March 21st or the 22nd. So you have lots of time. You're going to hear from some of our wonderful members over the next few weeks, including kiddos, about what this fellowship and this family has brought for them and why they are here. So that'll give you some things to think about. So the March 21st is a Saturday, 6 p.m. that evening at the fairgrounds, at the exhibition hall. We are having a celebration dinner. It is free for all of our members and friends. 6 p.m. Bring your card. This is a pledge card. Bring it with you that night. If for some reason you can't come that night, the following day is Celebration Sunday, which we've done the last few years with the procession to the basket, etc. So one of those two nights, please bring your pledge card with you. If for some reason you cannot be here either that night or the following night, please don't turn it in early. Please turn it in after that. We're going to some kind of a new system with our computers and everything, and we really want to be able to track things as they come in, and that new system won't be functional until about that weekend anyway. So please bring your pledge cards the 21st, the 22nd, or sometime after that. You can find me, you can mail it into the church, you can bring it, put it in the offering some other time, but please not until March 21st. So enough about pledge cards. I'm sure that you'll get sick of hearing me say that. So the front page of your packet is a little letter from Katie, our minister, a little blurb from the stewardship team, kind of just, again, reiterating our generosity theme because we know that this is a very generous group, but it just gives you a little bit more. One of the biggest questions I had last year was, what do our pledges do? You know, if I'm going to do this money thing, how do I know how it's getting used? So this year, I've printed on the next page our budget from last year, roughly. You know, obviously that'll change according to the needs and what the congregation decides this year. But this gives you a really good breakdown of all the different pieces of our budget. So you can see there's a lot of detail here, but if you're really wondering where it goes, this will give you a pretty good picture of that. So we are, and I hate to use the term because we are a fellowship, but we are, with this kind of a budget, we are rather a business. We have a $310,000 budget, and we have about 155 pledging units. So if you divide that, do the math. You know, it's important. This is what everything we do runs on our pledges, everything. We don't get grants, except I'm hoping that we'll get some for our new solar project. I'll know about that by the end of the month. But everything else we do runs on the generosity of this group, okay? The other thing, besides the budget, some people were saying, you know, I don't really know what is the right amount to give or what I should or whatever. This last little chart is what's called a fair share contribution guide. And it is simply another piece of information for you to use as you're thinking that over. This is totally up to you if you want to look at it or not. It's totally up to you to decide what you want to do. But for those who have asked, that's what this piece is about. Okay, so the timeline, the next 4 Sundays, you'll have about 3 or 4 minute blurbs from different members and kiddos from our fellowship. So that's 4 Sundays. The 5th Sunday is actually Celebration Sunday. So you'll see in your bulletins every week, there'll be a little reminder. There should be some. The monthly newsletter from this last month had a stewardship blurb in it. Blurb, I shouldn't say blurb. That sounds terrible. Information. The next newsletter will have some information in it again and a reminder. If you have any questions at all, you can email me. You can catch me. I'll be here every Sunday between now and the end of the campaign. You can call. You can text. You can do anything. And if I don't have the answer, I should have most of them, but if I don't, I'll find it for you and get back to you as soon as possible. So, and I'll be here after the service today. I'll be in the fellowship hall. So if you have any questions or concerns or harangues even, that's good. Just talk to me. Thank you so much.
And thank you to Cheryl and all the members of the stewardship team who worked so hard to have a thoughtful and values-based campaign.
My name is Nikki Unsicker. I'm one of the co-leaders of the Healing Racism team. In March, we are starting reading the book together, White Fragility. You'll hear more about that in a few minutes from Emily. But before we ask you to engage in this process with us, Emily and I wanted to kind of introduce ourselves to you. I've had the privilege to learn from the great trial attorney, Jerry Spence. He likes to help attorneys become human and learn how to connect with people and jurors and clients. And one of the things that he says is, "I'll show you mine when you show me yours." Basically, this idea that I can't ask you to be real and honest and messy with me until I show you mine first. So I'm here today, and I'm going to show you some of the mess that I have explored and waded through. So, healing racism. Why do we do this work? It is messy. It is scary. It opens all sorts of cans of worms. And it requires deep vulnerability. You might judge me. I might say something wrong. I might actually be wrong. Why don't I just stay quiet? Why don't you just stay quiet? Why do you come and engage in a book called White Fragility? Well, I'm going to tell you a little bit of a story about why this is so important to me, walking into the muck and the mire and doing it together. So about a year ago this time, I stood up and I did a talk about one of the seeds that was planted early in my life by a Navajo teacher, and we became pen pals, and he set me very early on my life in kind of this native justice direction. And so I'm not going to go back into that story, but just know that is the path I was put on from about the age 6, and we're going to fast forward to me being in college. So I'm in college, I'm in rural Indiana, and I'm a peace studies major. And it's January term, and I have the opportunity to study anything I want to study, and I create a class. I don't remember what the class was called, but what I was going to do is I was going to travel to the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, and I was going to learn. I was going to research, I was going to talk to people. But if I'm honest, I think part of the reason why I wanted to go is I kind of wanted to learn how to fix it. Now, Pine Ridge Reservation is the poorest county in the United States. The crime levels are astronomical. The unemployment is just, it kind of takes your breath away. Suicide levels and depression and alcoholism. Indigenous women who vanish. There are so many problems that the statistics, if you were to read them, look like a third world country here in the United States. And that is what I wanted to go and explore. Now, I also think that in this mess of the work we're doing, it is also very important to keep a sense of humor, and the universe always reminds me of that. And so I'm going to take a second to point out one of the funny parts of the story is that it was my mom and I doing this alone, and we rented an RV in January to go to South Dakota. If you know anything about RVs, horrible idea. On top of that, as we approached our RV, and the universe, it does this to me all the time. As I walk up, I just gasp, because on the side of the, like, rent RV US is this giant picture of smiling white people standing in front of Mount Rushmore. Now, Mount Rushmore has presidential heads carved into the sacred Black Hills of the Lakota Sioux people who live on Pine Ridge Reservation. And so not only am I this young, white, idealistic girl who knows no one on Pine Ridge but trusts that stories will be told, I have to do it walking out of such an offensive vehicle. So I asked people, why? What are the struggles? What are the pain? What isn't working? I mean, there's so many things. But some things that came up are, you know, fragmented land sources. The way that the U.S. government has set up the way that land is inherited and passed down and ownership means that for a 1/18th acre, there might be 20 people who have a claim to that. How in the world do you get to build anything? Okay, so let's say you get everybody to agree. Let's say you can find them. And they all say, yes, let's build a business. Yet you can't use the land as collateral to get a loan. Okay, all right. So these are big problems and things I could talk about all day. But the thing that I kept hearing was I kept hearing conversations about boarding schools, about how my mom was in a boarding school or my dad or my grandma or my great-grandma, and how it fundamentally changed the structure of their communities, how it changed the families, how it brought depression and fear and alcoholism and all the things that we hear into the families. And so I kind of left scratching my head like, what? And I started doing research on these boarding schools. And these boarding schools were all over the place, but we're going to start towards the beginning of the policy in the 1800s when it was not unusual for a child from the Lakota Sioux Reservation to be taken without permission from the family all the way to a place like Pennsylvania, okay? And the thing that, like, kicked me in the gut about my research was a realization and learning that some of the strongest advocates of this policy were progressives. So let's pause for a second and look at maybe why. So, education. Well, that's good, right? Civilization, we could argue, that's good. Empowerment, good. Maybe even the best yet is not massacring people. That is very good. So if you're going from this concept of the U.S. government's policy being extermination to then moving forward to education and empowerment, that sounds fantastic. And so it became progressive people who supported this concept that was kind of summed up in a quote of kill the Indian to save the man. And so these children would arrive at these schools taken from their families with no permission, taken from their families that they may never see again if they survive, So they show up. They cannot speak their language. If they do, they are beaten. Their hair, which for many tribes has there's sacred natures in their hair, is cut into a white person's style. The clothes are white people's clothes. They're taken from their family, but even more than that, they are taught that everything that they came from is bad and lazy and honestly evil. They are learned to hate the things that they were taken from. So then let's say if you survived this, you grow up and you've become a nice white person, essentially, but you're still Native and you're sent back to the reservations. And you're sent back with education and how to succeed in a white person's world, and you have tools like farming in Pennsylvania, except now you're going back to South Dakota and the things that you knew how to do, well, they don't work. And so you're trying and trying and trying to be a good, productive citizen, but your tools, they don't work. And you're in a community that you no longer have connection to, and that some people came back despising. This policy, it fundamentally changed whole groups of people and families. And there is pain even today from people living, even if they've never been to boarding schools, that it just infiltrated their families and their societies. So why do we do this healing racism work? For me, one of the reasons is because when I look at what progressives did with those policies, I have to wonder if I would have been one of those people. What happens when we don't recognize our own arrogance, our own privilege, and when we don't listen? And so I am asking all of us to engage in white fragility and healing racism so that we can learn to listen and never ever be part of something like this. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm Emily Thompson. I think many of you know that I'm new. I've been coming here for about a year, and it's been really wonderful to belong to this community. So thank you all for that. I thought it would be best to just share a little bit of my background and let you all get to know me and why I care so much about this work. So my first introduction to racism was actually through music, and I could listen to Nancy Griffith for hours as a little girl. And she has a song called "It's a Hard Life Wherever You Go." And in that song, she has a lyric where children slip to their windows and they watch their dad put on a white hood at night and they think, that white hood is all that I need. And as a child, that introduced me to the KKK, and it planted the seed that has grown into the work now that I do, which is teaching intercultural rhetoric and then coming here and offering to co-lead the Healing Racism team. I dedicated my studies in college and grad school to understanding the effects of colonization and how different writers have resisted attempts by white people, and often missionaries, to erase their culture and their identity. We can learn so much when we look through the lens of those who've been willing to share their stories, and exploring those stories is my passion, and that's my heart's work. But it's one thing to study racism, and it's another thing to get involved. When I finished my master's degree in postcolonial literature, I moved to Senegal and had the honor of teaching and learning from Senegal's future leaders at one of the best schools in the country. While there, my students were kind enough to let me in on their thinking. It was really painful to hear. One said, "We're black and Muslim. Americans hate us." Another, "If I were to go to the U.S., I could get killed." I wanted to deny what they said and defend my country, but I couldn't, because one merely has to watch the news to see why they felt this way. Many of those students still came here for graduate school. One of them is studying and getting her master's in peace studies at Georgetown right now. So they persisted in their goals despite their concerns about what it would mean to be black, Muslim, and African in the United States. These conversations happened in 2008, and I cannot express how cool it was to watch the elections in Dakar and have us elect our first black president. I got my hair cut at Obama Cuts in Dakar. And we had so much hope. We all wanted to believe this election was going to change things and that it would be better. But as we all saw with the 2016 election, much like Ta-Nehisi Coates has described in his book, We Were 8 Years in Power, we forgot to anticipate the intense backlash that comes when we have a major shift, like a black president. Now we have government leaders openly and unabashedly reinforcing racial stereotypes and creating policies that support white people while harming people of color, both inside and outside of the United States. Through the Healing Racism team, I am hoping that we can begin to address racism, both in the U.S. as a whole, but especially here in Durango. When I became a parent, I justified stepping out of this conversation for about 7 years because I was too busy learning how to be a mom. But racism happens whether we're busy or not, and I no longer consider opting out a valid choice. One of the most important steps we can take to actively work against racism is to look for opportunities to make small changes in our personal lives and in our careers. When I look at changes in my life, I just need to look at home. My family is multiracial, and my husband and I have to take a hard look at how we might perpetuate racism in the microcosm of our home as well as in our community. Learning how to talk to each other about race and advocate for our son is not optional. We have to explore what it means to raise a child whose heritage straddles Cape Verde and the United States, and who, growing up in a home with two white parents, often may not identify with us. Looking beyond the home, I started exploring what changes I can make in my career, especially when I felt like my world had been turned upside down. After the election, I didn't know how to teach. Like, how do I talk about important issues without turning my classroom into a tinderbox? I was asked to rewrite the revision for our undergraduate persuasive writing course a year later, and I saw that as an opportunity to shift the focus from classic Greek rhetoric, read, Eurocentric white lens, to a more culturally sensitive framework, Linda Flower's theory of intercultural rhetoric. When pitching that idea, I stumbled over my words because I was sure that I would be dismissed as too radical. But I wasn't. I spoke from the heart, and it was messy. But now Purdue Global, a university with 29,000 students, helps our students advocate for change in their communities by digging into their situated knowledge, seeking the voices of underrepresented stakeholders, actively challenging their assumptions, and proposing solutions that will bring tangible benefits to everyone in their community. All of this came from being willing to share an idea that I thought other people would not like. That's it. As our community dives into healing racism work, we must recognize that this is vulnerable and very brave work. It takes courage to look at our role in supporting a system that harms people of color, especially because having a role in maintaining that system probably does not align with who we want to be. It also takes courage to talk about race when we aren't sure if we're going to use the right words, or we might cause harm when we speak. When we do cause harm, we must turn towards that so that we can learn from it and repair the harm. My greatest fear is not that I will cause harm, but that if I do, it will go unchecked and unrepaired because I didn't come across as open to feedback. As we explore what we can do to dismantle racism, we need to start by clarifying the difference between prejudice and racism. Prejudice, as Beverly Tatum defines it, is a preconceived judgment or opinion, usually based on limited information. We all have this. We can catch them, even when we see ourselves resorting to generalizations based on a trait someone has. A common one I've heard in the media a lot lately is those millennials, those boomers, right? We're always more complex than the stereotypes that sometimes get used to define us or that we use to define others. And it's in all of our best interest to notice and actively challenge our prejudices. But racism is a deeper systemic problem. Robin DiAngelo, the author of White Fragility that we'll be reading in March, defines racism as prejudice plus power. The key is that it is systemic rather than individual. And there is a power imbalance. As white people, we have the right and the power and the responsibility to dismantle racism. As our fellowship turns toward healing racism work, we must do so with a deep commitment to exploring the places where we might take the safe route instead of getting into the arena. Sometimes it's just a safe emotional choice. I choose not to wonder what my life would be like if I were afraid that every time I got stopped by a police officer, I could die. Sometimes it's an active choice. I choose not to speak up when I hear a harmful joke that disparages a particular racial group. But facing the ways that we contribute to a system of advantages based on race is hard, and it will inevitably bring discomfort because we are turning toward a wound in our culture, and wounds hurt. But when we engage in this work together, knowing that we don't have the answers and that we are likely to make mistakes and speak imperfectly as we navigate something that we aren't really that comfortable with, We will progress together, and collectively we will work to improve our community. As we review White Fragility, we will ask that people commit to attending all four sessions, completing the work, and being open to giving and receiving feedback. I challenge each of us to spend the next few weeks thinking about how we might build up resilience so that we can accept feedback if the need for it arises. It is painful to face how we may cause harm, but we can't change something that we ignore. Instead, we must find the courage to look at it, be curious about it, and repair it without equating our mistakes with our self-worth. I look forward to doing this work with our fellowship and anyone who chooses to join us. Thank you.
Thank you, Nikki and Emily, for modeling what it looks like to be vulnerable and encouraging us to do the same. Come on in. We're about to get started. We waited a little late since we wanted to give you time to get coffee and
Oh, good. So
on at social time. So just a reminder, we do record this so that people who aren't here can listen to the talk, but they can also listen to the reflection time afterwards. So even though you might feel like, I've got a really strong voice, I don't need a microphone, we ask it to use it. And these work best by holding them with it facing you rather than like this. So be just a reminder about that. Okay, I see Emily coming, so we'll let her get some. We didn't want to start without you. I think today's experience could spark a lot of conversations.
Yeah.
So during this time, it's for you to have the opportunity to ask any questions that you have of the two people who spoke, either something you'd like to learn more about or something that just triggered a question in your mind as you listened to them, and also to share your own thoughts or comments if you... It triggered a sense that you have about the whole complexity of dealing with racism kind of work, and all of those are welcome. I'll first open the floor to Emily and Nikki to see if there's anything more they wanted to add on before we open the floor to everybody. So do you have anything you wanted to say at this point?
I would just say I'm blown away by like how much conversation this has already sparked. I mean, it seems like we're ready for this work, and that's really exciting.
I guess I'll just finish real quick with, remember how I was talking about the RV and how one side had Mount Rushmore? I feel like you guys should get to know what was on the other side. On the other side of the RV, so after going to Pine Ridge, we were going to Navajo. And on the other side of the RV was white children smiling in front of Monument Valley. So the universe really handpicked this RV. Sorry, sometimes it's nice to laugh.
Yeah. So, question anyone, comments, something to get us started.
Hi, my name is Vanessa. I think one of the real challenges that I feel is faced in this kind of work is the use of the word we. In speaking, in talking to a group, it's hard to feel not a part of a we in a room. It's hard to feel not white when when whiteness is being talked about. And I guess what it is, you know, like I understand myself as a person of privilege. And so I can say, yes, I want to engage in this type of work and understand that I would come to it as a person of privilege, as a mixed race person, as a person whose family was affected by boarding schools, whose family has a history of trauma, both from, you know, Mexico side and from North Dakota side. So it's just, I feel like, and I've had a conversation like this with a friend of mine who, and my mom, for that matter, who are people who have white-colored skin and yet have a feeling of apartness for whatever reason. And I think for me, it just highlights the need to understand that every single person in any situation has their own baggage, their own history, and often pain. You know, like humans have survived, you know, wherever they have come from, humans have survived and have struggled, and that, I don't know. Being able to speak to and see people as individuals with their own story, with their own feelings, is really important. So I think speaking to people of privilege or not, because if you're in a room and you say, I'm speaking to people of privilege, there's going to be those that don't. If I'm speaking to white people, there's those that are not. So being able to use I statements and own our own story.
Actually, can I pause us? Because I recognize that I did that, and I know that that was harmful. I actually, as I was speaking, went, wow, like what I just said is problematic, and I don't know how to navigate this or how to get out of it. And so I just want to own that I see that, and I don't know how to do a like group call to action without the word we, but we need, see, there I go again. But there must be a way, and I am willing to do whatever I can to find it, because I don't ever want to be responsible for alienating somebody, and I recognize absolutely that there were moments in my talk that I did that, and I felt it as I did it, and I'm sorry.
I actually also thought a lot about, as I was talking, I did acknowledge that I may very well say something wrong and be wrong, and that is something that, so, kind of to reflect, I think, what you just said in this, sometimes I have felt challenged to have conversations and open eyes with white people of things of our history that we don't know, that things that we have done to others, and I'm meaning we collectively of white people at the moment, and I totally acknowledge that I don't know how to do that inclusively or in mixed groups, and I will continue to work on that, and I'm sorry.
Hi. It occurs to me just listening to the two of you. Oh, here we go. Just in how many ways I can be non-accepting of people, and I realize skin tone is not the biggest one whatsoever. I'm kind of okay with skin tone. Culture is the tough one for me. And in an example, really simple, simple example, is I grew up in New York City when there were 7 million people there. My wife, Susan, who's sitting next to me, grew up in Eagle, Colorado when there were 700 people there. And everyone I knew were Democrats, and everyone Susan's family knew were Republicans. So when we married and moved here, we did and still do get along really well. And I am really different from them, and they and I recognize it. So anyway, all I'm saying is culture is a really big thing for me, and to think about, and I think about it a lot, as opposed to what we call race, and I don't even like that word, but you probably know why, because we really are the same race.
Something that, I don't know about you all, that I'm dealing with is the denial of racism in this country right now, and I grew up in a place where racial slurs were not only accepted, they were encouraged, it bothers me deeply that I have peers and people the same age I am that say, I don't know what you're talking about. Black people don't have it so bad. What are you talking about? And I think that's something that this country is struggling with. It's just very sad right now.
I just like to compliment the speakers. I think a really critical process is to begin to recognize when we do things that are not favoring our goals. The awareness, when you say something, the awareness of it, the willingness to apologize, but most importantly, you don't recognize it, you're not going to correct it. So, brava.
I think what I'm hearing, you know, we get caught up, especially in our culture, we tend to get caught up because we have a lot of white guilt, I think. And so we have we get caught up in the words like I, we, and not to discount those. But maybe what I see, maybe as an author, as a nurse, as somebody who has always experienced this trauma, and so I guess from a young child, was always thinking about it. And what it comes down to me is it's all about hate of an individual that chooses that. And when you choose that, it changes who you are. And it's the hate that causes the slurs, and the root of it all is that. And so I think if we tend, instead of getting maybe not so focused on the little details of saying I or we, but more of creating love and how to conquer that, is just because you can't sometimes, when somebody's caught up in that mentality, you're not going to be able to change their mind. They do believe that in their hatred, and that has changed their heart and spirit. You can't change that, you know, except by your own example and things that may just shift in their own mentality eventually. But initially, as long as you continue to live in that place of love and for everyone, and understand that we all are a reflection of each other and that we're all part of that same strand, you know, whatever we want to define it, but we're all part of that, where there's no one different, better or less on that strand. It's only the hate that does that. If that's making any sense.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I just I would like to slow it down a little bit and really reflect on what I think I did that caused a problem, because I actually think Vanessa is completely right. Sometimes when we use the word we, like I did, I drew a circle of belonging, and I think Vanessa was saying I felt left outside of that circle of belonging. And if I want to act in love, I need to know that so that I can. So we can come back into the circle together rather than have you outside of it. So in that case, I think I hear what you're saying. Like, we is a really useful way to do it. And what happens when we pause and go, when I use that word, who am I leaving out? And how might that be causing unintentional harm? And then repair it.
Yeah. It seems like the matching of coming from a place of love with the little things sometimes is the opportunity to open a door. So it's hard to have those really big confrontations or conversations, but sometimes through the little things, like here's something, as Vanessa said, here's something I felt, and that is a way that we take that step that moves us closer to getting that bigger sense of where are we and where do we want to be.
I have a concern about being seen as working in our own little social justice warrior bubble, and that term has become, frowned upon by quite a few. For example, if you haven't, I wonder why we don't look at and listen to, at least to hear what they're saying, people like the intellectual dark web, who I despise, but I still will listen to them anyway. Jordan Peterson being one of those that I think we need to listen and see who they're appealing to.
That's my, I think, greatest fear, and why I think, or why I feel I paused for so long is I came to a community. I have so many people who see things the way that I do, and I don't feel like I'm going to be checked when I say something that causes harm. I'm lucky to work at a university where I serve a very large military population and a lot of conservative students, and so they call me on it. But when I step into these communities, right, like how do we check each other and make sure that we're being accountable for ways that we assume that we're right when there's other positions that may be just as valid and available and not cause harm in that way?
I have a question. I heard a phrase this morning that was new to me, intercultural rhetoric. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so intercultural rhetoric is something that Linda Flower, she's a lit professor, came up with, and it's this idea that, rhetoric is classic Greek rhetoric. It was created back in ancient Greek, Aristotle, Socrates. And Linda Flower really took this position that, a really good example is a curfew policy in Philadelphia. They wanted to implement a curfew. And so all the adults got together, right, the social workers, the police, the school leaders, and they said, this is what we need. And then a bunch of black students said, this just means I'm going to get stopped more. It means I'm going to get arrested. It means I'm going to, leave, a dangerous environment for safety and possibly get in trouble for it. And intercultural rhetoric is a way of saying, we listen to people however they show up. So some students showed up and they did a rap song. And some did a back and forth, they acted out a scenario of being stopped by a police officer with a voiceover explaining the thought processes going through their head in the process. But it's this idea that there's no right way to speak and there's no perfect way to speak. But if we advocate for change, we need to always pause and think about what is the story behind my story? What am I thinking that influences the choices I'm making here? What is the impact of my choice and how may it affect stakeholders I haven't considered? And most importantly, who are the missing stakeholders and how do I seek them out so that I understand and advocate for this change by including them in my decision? So that's the heart of it.
Hi, I'm Jeff. I don't talk very often, but I think too much. I'm blessed to have Emily as a neighbor right across the street. It's just a delight to hear you in this dimension. So language is something I live inside. It's an operating system, if you will. And I've just had the thought that who's talking about the colonization of language when we sent the Indians, the Native American kids, to schools, we took their language away as a very high priority. How is that colonizing someone's mind? Can either of you comment on that a little bit?
I can speak for it from an African literature and that framework. I mean, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o has a book, Decolonizing the Mind, and he talks about this. He was forced to flee his country in exile because he refused to speak in English, even after colonization has ended in his country. So it is a colonization of the mind, right? That's the pure intention of it. Mm-hmm. And I would say it's very similar. I don't know the voices and perspectives of Native American speakers on this, except for what I studied back in 2000. So a long time ago.
Yeah. That was the intent. The intent was to destroy, traditional teachings and language and thought processes, and to send someone back to reservation spaces, and then, the hope was then, from what I've read, that then those individuals would change, the workings of the tribes and all of that from the inside. But from the people that I spoke to, what it ended up doing was just crushing people and leaving a lot of broken people and families. But that was all very intentional. The idea of the quote, kill the Indian to save the man, is really to kill that thought process and that person and to change them.
Mind me speaking on this. I wrote a biography on a Southern U elder, Russell Box Sr., and he talks about this in there. And it's basically from even the, also the person who wrote the foreword talked about the attitudes of our government and the policies at that time when he was born, which was 1934. And what it comes down to is they understood that if you took away somebody's language, you would kill their culture. And I thought about that a lot as I was writing this book, and I thought about myself because I'm Italian, full-blood Italian. And my when my family came from Italy, my mother's side, my grandfather learned to speak English by reading the Bible, and one, he had one in Italian and one in English. And so he was so proud of that, and he didn't want his children to speak Italian around him. So it was English at home. And my grandmother and great-grandmother only spoke, my great-grandmother only spoke Italian, so they heard Italians being spoken. And so that my mom's generation can understand Italian, but she can't speak it. I can't speak it or understand it. So I realized in two short generations, our whole culture was lost. And I'm currently taking Italian online because I just have to bring that back. But I realized how quick that was. And with Native Americans, it was done overnight and instantly to them. If that helps you at all.
But I'm thinking, too, that even now, in a much maybe smaller view, our language is a window into our thinking and influences our thinking, and our thinking influences our language. And that's why I think paying attention to what our language really is communicating, because we're on automatic pilot, I'm on automatic pilot with my way of thinking and how I express it. And I may, in that process, be denying or leaving out someone else's reality. Let's see, I think there was one more, and then we probably need to wrap up.
An example that I think more people should focus on, and it's not,
hold it up a little
bit. It's not by way of language, but the evisceration of the Palestinian culture and identity is something that's going on every day in an incredibly inhuman and internationally illegal way. Same goal, that is to destroy an identity of people and their culture. I just point that out as something that's ongoing.
So I actually, the next January, went to Israel-Palestine, and I studied how the language that is being used by, like, the settlers, and I spoke to two different groups of settlers. There were the people who were moving on to Palestinian lands because they couldn't afford to be anywhere else, and the government gave them benefits. And then I also was in the home of people who were, like, the zealous, religious, wanting the Palestinians to die people. And it is very interesting that some of the people living in the settlements simply just have nowhere else to go, can't afford anything else. But one of the things that I realized in that experience of sitting in all of that after the studying what I've been studying was the fact that the language used to get white people on board with what they did with Native people here is then the same language that was used to get Germans on board with what was done with Jewish people, to get white South Americans on board with apartheid, and then is what the Israeli government, media, whatever, is doing to get their own people on board, and that we are living in a time where it is happening. And, you know, to be in Jerusalem and to see that the way they designed that city is you literally, like, you could be driving right past, like, horrible things on the other side, but they've designed the city so that you go under a tunnel and you do all these things, and so you could be living in that city and have no idea about what's going on with the Palestinians, and you can believe what you're being told because you can't see it. I mean, it was the intentionality behind all of it and the way that these patterns and these languages are used, and these words are used over and over and over and over. I mean, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Last question or comment.
Actually, I'm Liza. I just wanted to mention that the immigration team is working on sponsorship, what possibly congregational sponsorship of someone who's incarcerated at the border. And again, it's yet another situation where so much, and I will use we as the United States has had policies affecting other countries that we're not being accountable about outcomes for. But it's just making me crazy. And so we have a group of people, not just UU, but a community-wide group starting to explore sponsorship, because many of them have passed a credible fear interview. They've been approved to be considered as refugees. They will have to go back to court to prove their case, which is also difficult. But they can't, they're incarcerated because they don't have a sponsor that they can go to until that court date, and they are sometimes incarcerated for months or even years. So if anybody's interested, on March 1st, we're going to provide a little lunch, and you can stay afterward like this and learn more about what that will look like. But we definitely need a team. It's it does require some resources to sponsor someone. I personally intend to, and we have some other people interested. So please come March 1st, and I really encourage taking the, you know, reading White Fragility and taking that class as a good way to prepare, because that is an intercultural experience that has a lot of layers because of their trauma. So thank you.
So thank you again to Nikki and Emily for helping us to open this door. And thank you for being willing to be open to seeing things as they are, and also things that we may be able to make better. So I hope you will think about signing up for our series. This is was in your bulletin today. There's a sign-up sheet at the social justice table, and it'll soon be on our website. You can sign up there. Thank you all.
Thank you.